Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're bringing you a report from our foray into the International Star Chefs Congress in Brooklyn, New York, last week. And we ran into just about everybody. Everybody was very busy, of course, so we didn't get to talk to everyone and record. It was Albert Adria's birthday, and Jose Andres was translating for him for his presentation, and he sang Happy Birthday, Albert, and everybody sang Happy Birthday to Albert. Who else? We had Nick Kokonis explain the talk reservation system, and I want to get him on the program soon to carry on with explaining
it. Because this guy's
very smart.
This guy's really smart. There's no question.
He is
about
smart,
that.
And it is smart as a reservation system.
So anyway, in addition to restaurant folks, owners, and chefs, and others, there's an awful lot of interesting food stuffs and drink stuff that are there for people to sample so they can add to the things that they're doing in their restaurant.
And first up, actually, is...
So we caught up with a few of those.
Yeah, Eduardo Jordan. Everybody's talking about him. He's the chef owner of June Baby and Sahara in...
Solaro
in Seattle. And he had a workshop, and I walked in and looked at it, and I said, "What is this you're doing, chef?" He said, "Chitlins." So everyone was talking about the wonderful smell emanating from his workshop.
So anyway, we're going to be starting off with Eduardo and chitlins.
He's doing soul food in Seattle. Talk about filling a niche.
And then we're going to move east and south a little bit to Rehoboth, Delaware, where Anne spent much of her childhood during the summertime, and a fascinating chef who's first name is Harry,
spelled
H-A-R-I, and his last name is Scottish. It's Cameron. We never did quite figure out where that came from, but he has two restaurants in Rehoboth, Delaware, and a very interesting story to tell about his own life. So we're going to start off with those two guys, and then we'll switch horses and continue on with the program.
And so here's Eduardo, Mexican in there,
and then,
too.
And then they'll be that's right.
Luis.
Sloppy. Sloppy, Peter. I don't have the sheet of paper.
Yeah,
in front
I have
of
it
me.
In my hand.
I don't have the script in front of me. But this gentleman, what's his name, Lily, again?
Luis Mota is the restaurant. Mota.
And Luis is one of the people actually.
Luis Mota is the chef owner, and his restaurant is going to be the second outpost of La Contenta.
The amazing thing is he was one of the people actually cooked for this august group of people.
Yes.
The following day. And he and his wife are in business together, and she explains how they managed to make that work out.
Yes.
So we got those three lined up, and then we'll be back to talk about some foodstuffs.
Start again. We have friends in the African American community in our home city of Pittsburgh, and we've met in other places, who say, "I won't eat chitlings in anybody else's house. I'll only eat them in mine." Now, Eduardo Jordan from Seattle, you're doing a whole lot more than that with chitlings, not just cooking in your own house, but for lots of people. Tell us what that's all about.
Chitlins for me is, part of my history, part of something that was part of my family. And when I open up a restaurant, it's basically like me having my house and opening up my house to my friends, to my family, to my guests. And so chitlins are part of my menu at June Baby Restaurant in Seattle. I've been serving it from day one. One as an exploration of Southern food, but also just a little indication of who I am and where I come from.
Well, you had a crowd here, and you enlisted the help of the crowd to actually make the chitlings. What's the process like?
Where I'm from, we call it chitlins, and chitlings are the actual way you say it. But in the South, we call it chitlins. But the whole process, it's a tedious process. It ends up being a 4 to 6 hour process from the actual cleaning of the intestines, cutting and braising, which may end up being about 3 to 4 hours. And then, whatever else you're serving it with, But it's a tedious process in making sure that it's pristine and clean, and then also tender.
And what's it like when visitors to your restaurant coming for the first time see that on the menu? What kinds of reactions do you get?
The reaction to seeing chitlins on the menu is kind of, I think people get a better understanding of the restaurant. It's a true Southern restaurant. It's not gimmicky. We're not trying to do trendy things. We're serving the food that I grew up on, food that shaped America during the time of slavery, during the time of Southern soul food growth. I'm touching the historical standpoints, the historical ingredients, and historical content of Southern food is presented on my menu in my restaurant. And, you know, I think chitlins is part of that story that I'm trying to tell. And having it on the menu, I think people have a better understanding of what this restaurant really is.
Now, Seattle, Washington, and the American South, what's the connection there?
Yeah, we're probably as far as you can possibly be in America from the South. But I'm a Southerner, tried and true. My grandparents have history in Georgia. I was born and raised in Florida. My grandparents live there now. My mom lives there. And that's how I learned how to cook, was Southern food. As a culinarian, I traveled. I've eaten a lot, and I ended up in Seattle. And so I'm just telling some of my story in my restaurant 3,000 miles away. And I think people appreciate what is happening and who's presenting Southern food to them in Seattle. So it's been a blessing. It's an honor that, you know, people are accepting Southern food in Seattle and believe in me and trust in me that I can deliver Southern food to them.
Now, your picture recently appeared in one of the big food magazines, so you're getting quite a lot of visibility.
Yes, it's been an honor. I've received a lot of press over the year or two for both of my restaurants, Solari and June Baby. You know, it's just a recognition of Southern food and a new face to the Southern food restaurant scene, in a sense. Southern chef, you know, here's a new face.
Now, to show you're not entirely afraid, having dealt with food of the American South, you also took your class here through the preparation of a French delicacy. Tell us just a little bit about andouille.
Yes. So andouille is another preparations of pig intestines, which are basically the chitlins. And I just wanted to kind of show like a finesse version of chitlins, or at least of what we assume is a finesse version. I want to be able to put chitlins right next to an andouille sausage at any point in time, and that's what I wanted to present today, is that these are two of the same ingredients presented in different ways, presented by our discovered or actually created by two talented cultures, and both of them should be equally respected, and that's what I wanted to present today, in a sense.
Now, I wanted to include one other country, because you slid in some arugula with the andouille, but you dressed the arugula and you just ran by, and people didn't notice that it was PX vinegar. PX vinegar, as you and I both know, is from southern Spain.
Yeah, you know, like, I'm not afraid to, like, mix a little bit in, but it's one for me, and the andouille sausage and having arugula, just bringing a little extra spice. The vinegar brings that nice pop and still have a little sweetness. So, you know, it wasn't like I'm going to be only cultural-centric food that I'm not going to, like, put olive oil from France on my menu or put vinegar from Spain on my menu. It's there. It helps enhance flavors and bringing a different aspect to the food.
Well, thank you so much for a wonderful demonstration. We really enjoyed hearing you and watching you at work. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us on the menu today.
All right. Thank you, Peter.
Chef, tell us the origin of your name, which I thought was delightful.
Yeah. So my name's Hari Cameron. I'm a chef in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, at a restaurant called Amuse. We also own Fast Casuals called Grandpa Mac. But my name is Hari. My dad was definitely of this hippie generation where meditating on ashrams. He was heading on his way to the hospital reading the Bhagavad Gita, which is Hindu texts. The name Hari is a name that means one who removes miseries and delivers from sorrows. So he always loved the name. And yeah, my middle name's Leaf and my last name's Cameron. So.
And now, you're of course, the star chefs, and you were just making the most extraordinary oysters. Tell us about that.
Certainly. So this is my third year cooking here at Star Chefs. This year, I've been paired with Mara Forna. They make beautiful pizza ovens, and today I'm cooking on their new beautiful charcoal grill oven. So we're taking Tom's Cove oysters, a local oyster. I'm a chef in Delaware, and these are Virginia oysters. We're lightly roasting them till they pop. We're topping them with a little bit of cultured butter, where we actually have taken popcorn and grown Aspergillus oryzae from Mentimus mold on it, which makes miso, sake, soy sauce. And then we've taken that and fermented it into a beverage called amazake. So it's a popcorn amazake. And then from there, we've taken that cultured beverage and churned it into cultured butter. So we took it, added it to our milk, which is local Delaware milk, churned it into the butter. Then we're topping a little bit of pickled oyster root or salsify. We actually ferment a lot of things in the restaurant, so the salsify is pickled in a local brewery's beer vinegar to make the vinegar in-house as well. Then we're topping it with a little bit of fennel crystals. So these couple days I'll be cooking some lamb, these beautiful oysters, and I'm cooking with Polyscience, which makes beautiful, very precise cooking apparatuses, and Mara Forna, which makes awesome pizza ovens and charcoal burning ovens.
Now, there wouldn't be any room for dogfish head product in your itinerary, huh?
So tomorrow, actually, I'm going to be cooking beautiful local Delaware clams. They're with tarbay, white beans, some lamb and douya, and then we're going to deglaze it with the dogfish head sequench ale. The reason I chose sequench is because it has lime profile, has that yeast and malt profile, and it's wonderful. It has black lime, and it has the acidity, so it'll really cut through the chilies and the fat of the lamb and really complement the clam as well.
So what time are you going to be starting tomorrow so we can be first in line?
That's a good question. You know, it's this oven's heat up very quickly, and as soon as the ovens are ready, and we'll be rocking it. And, yeah, definitely, you definitely don't miss the lamb. The lamb is wonderful. The lamb is, you know, we don't have time set. It's all up in the air at this point. Tomorrow I'll actually be cooking in the Polyscience booth, and I'll still kind of come out here and do the clams as well. So, yeah, just check us out. I'm sorry, I don't know the time at this point.
Website.
Hari Cameron, the website of your restaurant is?
Yeah, so it's www.amuse-rehoboth.com. And also Grandpa Mac, which is my quick service fast casual restaurants, grandpamac.com. And you can find these wonderful wood burning ovens and pizza ovens at Mara Forney. And then also check out the Control Freak from Polyscience. Awesome cooking instruments, cooking some beautiful food today. There's going to be so much great food around us. It's, again, just smell the smells, the sights, and great times here at Star Chefs. So.
Well, it was a great meeting you.
It might seem strange that we're at Star Chefs 2017 in Brooklyn, and the next couple we're going to talk to have a Mexican restaurant, not an all-American restaurant. Who would like to tell us how that happened?
Hi, my name is Luis, and I'm the chef of this Mexican restaurant called La Contenta. Why Mexican restaurant? Well, I got here. I'm an immigrant, you know. I met my wife in Mexico back in 1990. She's an American. I came here and I started working in the restaurant business. Why in the restaurant? Because at least when you work in the restaurant, at least you have some food to eat. So that's the way I start, you know, in the restaurant. And I start as a dishwasher. I start working with Italian. I start learning, you know, how was about ingredients, about tastes, and little by little, I mean, being working or living in a city of New York, being so cosmopolitan, so many different cultures, so many different restaurants, so I have the opportunity to work in several different cuisines, talking about Italian, talking about French and American. So as a Mexican, Well, I decided, you know, why not? Mexican food is something like it's close to my heart and in my memories. So that's the way, you know, that we decide to open a Mexican restaurant.
A lot of people's idea of a Mexican restaurant is Taco Bell. Now, clearly that's not exactly what you're doing, but what's the style of cooking? And what, is it based on things that are happening in Mexico rather than things that are happening in the rest of the world?
Well, being Mexican, I mean, like, the safest thing to do or to cook is the food that we try as a kid, the food that my mother used to make. I'm from the north of Mexico City, and I live in the coast, so our diet was with a lot of seafood and shrimp. So everything's around that, and the ingredients mostly was about tomatoes, chiles, and corn. But what I can say about Mexican food is about the using the different kind of chiles, the pepper. That's what I give the Mexican cuisine the soul, the peppers, the different kinds, red, big, green, spicy, sweet. That's what exactly gave you the Mexican food, you know, the reason to be.
Now Lisa, give me your excuse. You were already in the hospitality business?
No, I was in banking and basically pretty miserable doing that. And I was laid off from my job last November 2016, and my husband gave me the opportunity to work with him more directly.
Okay, so the restaurant was already open. I guess I should have asked you how long you've been open, and then there's something else coming next that's sort of news.
Well, this right now my restaurant is open. It's my third project here in New York. I had two other projects before, but I left because my partners. I mean, so that's why it's so important to choose a partner. It's like before you get married, you gotta be sure it's somebody who you wanna spend the rest of your life. So I did my choices with my partner. So that's why my first place and second place I left because you know, problem. But now this is my third. My partners, they look pretty good, strong and everything. So we very close to open the fourth one. And it's going to be also the same, you know, Mexican restaurant with a lot of soul.
So you're now a full-time business and work partner with your husband. How's that working out?
It's working out well because we don't need to be together. I can work remotely from somewhere else. So I handle all the social media, and I don't have to physically be there. I can do it wherever I am. So it's working out really well.
So let's recap then. The restaurant name is La Contenta. I don't know where 102 Norfolk Street, New York is. Perhaps you can verify the name and the website and where exactly 102 Norfolk Street is.
La Contenta, restaurant La Contenta is located in the Lower East Side. Lower East Side is an up-and-coming neighborhood in New York. It still have, you know, the old New York that everybody miss. And it's really exciting. And like I said, you know, 102 Norfolk Street is just like a 3 blocks from the Williamsport Bridge. And it's really exciting. I mean, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, used to see a lot of prostitutes over there, you know, and drug dealers, even in noon. But now it changed. It's a lot of galleries. It's a lot of restaurants and a lot of nightlife. And, yeah, it's one of the best neighborhoods in New York.
Now, just quickly, you mentioned, was it the Williamsburg Bridge? But you're on the New York City, the Manhattan side?
Yes, it's next to the Williamsburg Bridge and Manhattan side. That's correct.
Okay, well, you're here at Star Chefs. Are you hoping to pick up lots of tips about how to run your restaurant better?
Oh, definitely. It's something I was already like in three different seminars, and I think it helped me a lot because it take me out from the food and made me think more like a restaurateur. And I think it's so many things involved not just cooking, but about social media, about how you deal with customer, and, well, it's so many things in a restaurant.
Lisa, you get the last word, whatever it is.
Owning a restaurant and managing a restaurant is extremely tough work, but it's very rewarding, and I think it's a really positive thing because you're giving joy to people. What's more fun than going out and having dinner with your friends or loved ones? I mean, thing to be doing, I think. So it's worth the effort.
Well, let me warn you, next time we're in New York, we're coming. So we hope that you'll be expecting us and we'll have a good time.
Yes, of course, and we've been expecting you with a nice mezcal, with a nice mezcal and a little bit of nice mole, I believe. Yeah, that will go well, you know, with mezcal.
Thank you so much.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
A big part of the experience at Star Chefs, of course, is eating your way around the world. And didn't we just do that? We were exploring, I happen to like Spanish tinned fish, especially things like octopus and squid and so forth. But anyhow, I was exploring Spanish cheeses and this man leaned over and he said, "I've been on your show." Of course, we never see who the person is over the phone lines,
yeah,
this was Max McCallum.
McCallum, yeah.
And we've interviewed him more than one time, several times. He's an expert on cheese in general, and he is particularly enamored now. Well, right now he's particularly enamored with cheeses from Spain, and boy, are they good. Other food suppliers that we interviewed, David Sasuga from Fresh Origins, which is in South Dakota. Is it South Dakota?
San Diego.
San Diego.
My shorthand on the script is SD, but it's
okay.
Michael. San Diego. Lots of edible flowers in particular.
Oh, we have beautiful stuff.
Wasabi leaves and stems.
Which
he's going to explain about.
And then Michael Fabro, who was this excellent Ora King New Zealand salmon, our face with.
There were actually three exhibitors from Australia. One dealing with Chilean sea bass, or mm-hmm. as they properly call it, Patagonian
right.
toothfish.
Exactly.
And another one, it was, I've forgotten the kind of fish it was now. And the only person who was allowed to talk to us was in Australia, so we couldn't talk to him. and Michael from Ora King Salmon, what's his last name?
Fabro.
Michael Fabro talked most eloquently about excellent king salmon farmed in New Zealand.
Well, the food was so good at this Congress.
couldn't drag ourselves away. I wish we had some in front of us right now. So anyway, here's the foodstuff section coming right up.
Five, we met an old friend without realizing we were doing that, because we don't necessarily see our guests sometimes at the other end of a telephone call. But Max McCallum actually recognized Ann and Peter probably from our photograph, because we've never met in person before. But we caught up with Max working with cheese from Spain. We're, of course, at Star Chefs. Max, tell me what you're up to.
I am here to help celebrate and introduce some of the great varieties of cheese that are produced in Spain. By many people, it's considered to be the capital of gastronomy, Spain in its entirety. And I have loved Spanish cheeses since the beginning of my career. And they're distinct. They're inimitable. There's nothing quite like them produced anywhere else. Styles that are call themselves Hispanic, but there's such a broad variety of cheese types produced in Spain. Sheep especially, quite a few goats. And then a smattering of cow's milk cheeses and mixed milk cheeses. And so they deserve celebration. And so that's what I'm here to do on behalf of my Spanish cheese-making friends.
Now, you were talking about not just promoting, but reviving some older cheeses and also popularizing variations of Spanish cheeses, because everybody, you said, just knows Manchego.
Right.
Explain a little bit about these other cheeses that you're reviving or updating or new ones or whatever.
Yes, for the traditional cheese types, some of them have fairly limited production. So it's not a, it hasn't been a very big part of the export market of Spain. And some of them are ancient in style, such as Roncal in the Basque region, Idiazabal, Cabrales, of course, which is fairly well known because it's such a big cheese, you'll never forget it once you've tasted it. But then there's some of the Extremadura cheeses, Torta del Casar, Queso Ibores, which we have here today, which I've loved since I was first introduced to it, maybe 20 years ago, and outstanding cheese types. And then there are other hidden gems that are even less well-known, fortunately, they're receiving some celebration in Spain. I think it's a credit to the country as a whole that they recognize that cheese, as well as other agricultural products, are potentially a very important export commodity for Spain. And I think that's part of what is driving the invention and the new cheese recipes that I'm seeing. I was just in Spain earlier this year at a cheese conference called Tierra de Quesos, and I tasted a variety of types that were, they couldn't call themselves by the DOP name, but they were made the way they used to make the cheese years ago, such as a raw milk version of a cheese called A Fuego Pitu from Asturias, which I think by its designation, I'm fairly certain it must be made with pasteurized milk, but there is a one operation that's making it the way they used to make it with raw milk, and it's it was delicious. I knew it had potential. Even the pasteurized version is very nice, but it kind of reminds me of in England where the Stilton, like the old Stiltons made with raw milk, a recipe they've been working on for many years, and I just had it a couple of weeks ago at another festival, and I think it's come a long way. Yes.
Now, one of the things that has almost astounded us over the years we've been doing the program is the extent to which American cheeses have been gaining reputation across the world, winning awards at the London Cheese Festival, which is the biggest one that's out there. And I remember we talked to John False one time, and he discovered that in Louisiana, not a place you would imagine that people would be developing cheese, he found they were. He made some, took it off to London and won an award.
Why
is this happening?
I believe it. A number of reasons why this is happening. One is that wherever there is wine appreciation, cheese appreciation will soon follow. And the big appreciation for wine started to happen back at the Judgment of Paris. But I would say in the mid-late 70s, Americans started to know the difference between Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauvignon. And soon thereafter, cheese follows along. I think that's part of it. But one thing that I am, part of my mission is to celebrate cheese as a near-perfect food. And I think that Americans are beginning to recognize that cheese is actually good for you. That's one reason that I am working on this next book, is I want to celebrate cheese for its nutritive values. But this is not just occurring in the United States. And I used to think that this is where the excitement is occurring in the cheese world today, like you say, winning awards in international competition. But I'm seeing in Spain, for example, and some in Italy, definitely England, a lot happening in England right now. Switzerland, to die for, some of those cheeses. But it's global. Even in Asia, the fastest growing per capita consumption of cheese is happening in Asia right now.
As an aside, we were at a presentation of, they were talking about Asiago, and they were talking about Sardinia, and you know, it's a blue zone, so people live to be 125 and so on. They attributed Italian fashion, they attributed it to their cheese.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but you mentioned your books, and I thought that you might help our listeners. Your books are the greatest introduction to cheese that I've ever read. Can you kind of just run through? You have four.
Correct.
Working on the fifth, the titles.
Right. My first book, The Cheese Plate, was for me, it was my introduction. I knew very little, but I'd been at it for a few years, and so it's a good introduction with beautiful photography. A little bit about how to. Because I used to be a sommelier, how to pair it with wines. The second book, The James Beard Award-Winning Cheese, A Connoisseur's Guide to the World's Best. And it was about 200 of what I believed to be the best cheese in the world, and many of them I still believe are some of the best cheese made today. The third book was an idea that my editor had, and that is it was based on a series of cheese classes I was teaching called Mastering Cheese. So she proposed the title Mastering Cheese. That book has done very well, and it won Gourmand Cookbook Awards Best Cheese Book in 20 years. And my fourth book is Max McCalman's Swatch Book of Wine and Cheese Pairings. They're very handy, especially for places where you can pick up cheese and wine in the same shop. And so the next book is on nutrition and safety and debunking myths and misinformation about cheese. I'm learning a lot. I don't pretend to be a scientist, but I'm trying to, like I do in my other books, I'm trying to take some of the science and put it into easy-to-understand terms the best that I can, so it will help people in the industry as well as cheese enthusiasts to understand, like you say, how near perfect the cheese is.
How great to run up with you, Max. We'll have another cheese book. I suspect number five is brewing somewhere.
Yeah, well, yeah.
So we'll talk to you again when that one comes out. In the meantime, thank you so much for your time.
Yes, we're going to be talking to David Sasuga, who is the owner of a company that is at the top of everybody's list of imaginative products and really forward-thinking ingredients, Fresh Origins, which gives you an idea of the kind of products they produce. David, I'm going to ask you, first of all, to give us an overview on the products that you produce and market. And then I want to focus in on the one that was most startling to me. Let's see your general.
Well, thank you. Hi, Anne. We grow microgreens and edible flowers in San Diego, California. We are fortunate to have the world's best climate for growing this type of product, and it results in a really high-quality product and allows us to produce all year round. We supply all of North America with these products, and we've been doing it for about 22 years.
Well, now, I've been eating for longer than that, and I think I've eaten, except for some really, really obscure kinds of things, I've eaten pretty broadly about what's possible. Something that I've, of course, eaten wasabi before, but it never occurred to me that you could eat other parts of the wasabi plant besides the root. Now, I want to know from you, you grow it here, which is an innovation anyhow. How many parts do you use, and tell us about the qualities of the leaves that we just ate?
Well, yes, we grow the wasabi for the leaf and the stem. We do not sell the root because we are keeping that so that it will perpetuate the production of the leaves and stems.
Oh, okay.
The leaf is a beautiful, round, dark green leaf with a nice succulent stem. The root, of course, has the most pungent flavor, and the stem is a little bit less, and then the leaf is even less. So the leaf has a really nice kind of fresh, leafy flavor along with that kind of spicy wasabi taste. And then the stem, we chop it in small pieces, and we get even more of that spicy flavor along with a nice texture, really unique succulent texture. So the leaf and stem is a really beautiful, fresh, useful part of the wasabi plant that is often overlooked.
Yeah. Now, I had two types. I had one that was salt cured and one that was plain fresh. Tell us about that.
Well, our chef, Chef Shola, is very creative, and he wanted to intensify the flavor of the wasabi leaf, and he did so by dunked them in water, and while they were still wet, he sprinkled it just a light sprinkling of sea salt, and then he put them in a vacuum pack and kept them for I think a couple of days in the package, and then they were just the flavor of the wasabi, especially the spiciness, was intensified, and along with that little bit more savory note with the salt. So it was really incredible as you tasted. It was a really nice way of showcasing that product.
Now, listeners, picture a stuffed grape leaf, because that's how it's sort of rolled around a filling. But, you know, David, I'm worried about the root. I mean, that's what everybody wants. How many years can you just keep a root growing?
The root, I know it's valued, and it's quite rare here in the United States. But we can get leaf production from the root for about 2 years, and then we have to start a new plant. So for us, the root is valuable in order to produce the leaves.
I'm worried. What do you do with the poor old roots? You put them out as pasture.
Well, we find a use for them. The roots are highly valued, and they're very flavorful, of course. So, but our focus is the leaf and stem.
Okay. Is there even a rarer ingredient you grow? What's the oddest flower you grow?
I'm not sure. We grow hundreds of varieties, We try to find unique things. One of the more unique that we've recently introduced is called Kinome leaf. Kinome leaf is a very beautiful small leaf that has many leaflets. It has a very intense floral citrusy flavor, and it comes from the same plant that produces the Sancho pepper, which is also known as a Sichuan pepper. And so the leaf has a very fresh version of that flavor, along with the tingle, the mouth feel that where it tingles, makes your tongue tingle for quite some time after eating it. So it's really amazing. So that's one of our latest products that we're offering here at Star Chefs.
Were you a botanist?
Not by... by degree, not by training, but by hobby. I'm a hobbyist as a botanist, I suppose.
How about giving us a website?
Freshorigins.com.
Well, what a great surprise. When you feel like you've done it all and are jaded, to find something new and fresh and wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
What fun it is to meet a far Antipodean. Because listeners, those of you who are familiar with the program, will know that Peter lived in Australia, and that part of the world has some of the world's best seafood. But we're sitting in Brooklyn, New York right now, and I'm talking to Michael Farbro from Aura King Salmon, who's continuing to prove that the Southern Hemisphere has the world's best seafood. Michael?
Well, I absolutely agree with that last statement. I think it does have the best seafood. but I can't claim to be a native New Zealander. I am an American, but I do happen to work for a New Zealand-based company, and that's Orakim Salmon.
And Orakim Salmon comes from, geographically, help our listeners out who don't know the Southern Hemisphere all that well, about where it is between the different parts of New Zealand.
Sure, absolutely. So Orakim Salmon comes from New Zealand, and more specifically, the South Island of New Zealand. It's a farm-raised salmon. So we do everything from have our own breeding program, so literally from the egg all the way through to the adult fish and the harvesting and the processing. Now, salmon, as you know, live their juvenile lives in freshwater and their adult lives in the sea, in saltwater. So our breeding program and juvenile program is in the Takaka Valley. So this is above Golden Bay on the South Island. It's a beautiful, beautiful spot in the country, Green Valley. And it's really blessed with literally some of the clearest water in the world. Our hatchery is fed by a spring, the Te Waikoru Pupu Springs, that has been rated the second clearest water in the world, surpassed only by a lake just up the street a little ways. Now, why is that important? Because salmon, like a lot of fish, thrive in clear, pure water with a lot of oxygen. So that's really critical to getting salmon off to a great start. Our salmon will spend about the first 6 to 10 months of their life in this freshwater facility. And then when they're at the proper age, we'll bring them out to the sea where they'll spend their adult lives in the Marlboro Sounds. Now, a lot of your listeners might be familiar with wines from the Marlboro region. So this is a region in the northeastern part of the South Island. And the Marlboro Sounds are the coastal waters in between the North and the South Island.
That's a really silly question. How do you get them back?
You mean back in order to harvest them?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Back so you get your money back.
Yeah. Excellent question. And, you know, in the early days of salmon farming in New Zealand, they hadn't really figured that one out, and they lost a lot of salmon. They kind of assumed they would come back to spawn and they would be able to capture them that way. Didn't really work out so well, and they lost quite a bit of their investment. So today, you know, we figured a few things out over the last few decades. Our farms are netted. So if you went out to look at one of our farms in the Sounds, like to visualize it, if you flew overhead in a helicopter, the footprint is about the size of a football field. And then if you went below the surface of the water and kind of looked at it in a 3D perspective, you have nets that go down about 35 meters or a little over 100 feet, and that creates the environment in which the salmon live.
Now, do they come back to spawn, or you just catch them in the nets?
Yeah, we actually want to harvest them before they spawn, because king salmon, as with other species of salmon, when they start to spawn, they'll go through a lot of physiological changes, and those changes aren't really good for quality from a culinary perspective. So you want to harvest them before they spawn. So we'll go in when, and this is usually when they're about 2.5 years old. We'll go in and harvest the fish, but before that spawning period.
But in the meantime, they don't get away.
No, thankfully they don't get away. Yeah, they stay within that environment, and the nets are very effective. We also have predator nets in addition to those, which actually keeps predators from coming in. Seals are a predator, that's really the number one we have to be careful of. But there's certainly salmon are tasty for a lot of other species besides humans, so we have to make sure we keep those out.
So seals are a lot like you and I. We love the taste, and that's what we should come back to, because I picked Michael out to talk to you, listen, to bring him to you, because their salmon is just so delicious. Yeah. Is that due to the farming, or is it due to the breed, or what is it due to?
Yeah, I like to think it's due to a lot of different factors. I think number one, we farm king salmon, and kings are a fairly rare species and generally considered the most premium. So, and why is that? It's typically, I would say, most people would agree, because kings carry more fat. They have a higher oil content, a higher fat content, so you get a lot of flavor. Now, our Aura King salmon, which we've been breeding and raising for, you know, close to 30 years now, we're on our ninth generation, we've developed almost our own breed of kings, and we compare it sometimes to a Wagyu program. We say it's the Wagyu of salmon. So we have tremendous marbling in our fish with a very high fat content. It's 25% fat to lean. So you get great flavor, really tremendous kind of elegant, silky texture, and it's truly something unique.
It's interesting. I'll share something with you that you may never have heard before. We interviewed a gentleman who smokes salmon in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is not exactly coastal as far as salmon is concerned. Just in case you're wondering, it's just off Lake Huron and Lake Michigan in the center of the Great Lakes region of the U.S. But his company said, he said, we like to smoke farm salmon because we like the fat distribution so much better than the wild salmon. Would you agree that's an advantage of yours when it's in the hands of a chef?
Yeah, absolutely. Chefs often look for a consistent product. So a farm salmon has a lot more consistency than the wild, not only with fat content, but a lot of other characteristics too. Like when it comes to a wild salmon, where it's caught in terms of how far it is along in its spawning, that can make a difference in its flesh quality. Sometimes you might get wild salmon that could have a little bit of muddy flavor. Now, I don't want to disparage wild salmon. They're fantastic. They're delicious. But you have a wider spectrum in quality and characteristics, whereas farm salmon, typically you have more consistency, yeah.
Now, is Aura King somehow available to the general public, or does it just go to the trade?
It's mostly to the trade. We're predominantly geared towards the restaurant trade, food service industry, but there are some specialty retailers that do carry our product. Here in the New York area, it's available, for example, through Fresh Direct, which delivers to people's homes. There's Agata and Valentina is a local retailer that carries our fresh salmon. And then we also have our own smokehouse in New Zealand, and we do a smoked version, and that's available through Dean and DeLuca in Soho and Fairway Markets.
And it all gets here from the Marlborough Sound in Australia, I mean in New Zealand. How quickly is it here, picked yesterday and here tomorrow?
It's actually pretty amazing. So we ship to New York three times a week. And from harvest, or meaning when the fish are pulled out of the water and harvested and then the process kind of starts, from that moment that they're out of water to the time they land at JFK, it's more or less about, say, 65 to 70 hours, which is pretty quick and pretty amazing. And from that time, we bring them into Nelson, New Zealand, where we do our processing, where we'll gill them and gut them, pack them, ship them. So it's a quick process. And they fly on commercial aircraft. So if you're ever on vacation in New Zealand and you're flying back to the States, there's a very high likelihood you have fresh seafood in the cargo hold, and also a good chance you might have some more King salmon down there.
Michael, thank you so much for talking to us. It's been a pleasure to meet you and to talk to you and find out something more about the world trade in salmon.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And of course, no event about food and drink would be complete without lots to drink, and there were quite a number of people with interesting products in that category.
Well, there was a whole new idea that this humongous cocktail hour that they put on.
Yes,
where
yes.
they had everything from classical drinks to the experimental modernist cocktails and people doing their mixology tricks. It was really something.
There was a guy who was the real winner was the only guy who was who actually had beer there. He had beer from the Brooklyn Brewery. But that's not even what he sells. So I thought that was particularly clever. But a funny thing is going on. There's a French invasion going on with hard liquor from other parts of the world. So we caught up with two young people from different parts of France who were representing Pisco from Chile,
yeah.
Pisco from Peru. And then not, last but not least, Emma Charon, who's from somewhere in France, I forget where, but she was peddling rye and bourbon whiskey from Iowa, which is pretty decent stuff.
A little cultural shock there.
So here's a little liquid to finish out the program.
Okay, listeners, all of you went through your whole life knowing that the most famous drink from Latin America is a pisco sour, and you could only get a pisco sour in Peru. Well, of course, always exploring what's going out there in the world of food and drink, we found something very different. So Mathilde or Elliot, I'm not sure which, from France, were working for a company from Chile where they import, what is it called?
Pisco from Chile. We are CNI Brands.
Doesn't seem right.
Yes, we Pisco was born when the Spanish invaded Latin America. So Peru was one big country. So that's when Pisco was born. So Chile and Pisco and Peru were just one country. So that way sometimes it's like there's this big
country. Now, if I remember my Latin American history, about which I know very little, the Chileans and the Peruvians and the Bolivians all used to fight quite a lot between each other, so that they might have been part of the same Spanish Empire at one time, but then all of a sudden they fell out with each other.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure. Can you repeat your question, please? You know my English.
No, Elliot just joined the company, and he's from France, so I guess he wouldn't know a lot about Latin American history. Mathilde, maybe you don't know either, but apparently the Bolivians and the Chileans and the Peruvians all used to fight together.
Yeah, of course. This is the Spanish came with the varieties of grapes.
Okay.
Come in a vice royalty of Peru.
Okay, so the grapes that are used in Chile and Peru are very similar?
They're actually different. In Peru, they use 8 varieties of grapes. In Chile, we only use 2, which is Pedro Jimenez and Mascaro of Alexandria. And our pisco, the Control C and Mistral, are 2 pisco that use a blend of both grapes. Both are very different because one is an age and the other one is aged between 1 and 3 years. So it's very different. The difference with Peru as well is Peru is aged in a barrel that won't leave any taste. So it's not oak barrel or anything like this. And in Chile we can use oak barrel. So that's one of the big differences.
Now let's go through that again, Elliot. The different varieties from the regular to the 2 twice distilled to the third
For Peru you can make just 1 distillation, and from Chile you can make double distillation or triple distillation. That's why there is a big difference as well between a pisco from Chile and a pisco from Peru. And for the distillation in Peru you can add water, but in Chile you can add water.
You cannot.
In Chile you can add, but in Peru, you cannot.
It's all very complicated, right?
Yeah, because in Peru, you cannot distill it over proof. But in Chile, we can, and we just add a little bit of water, because otherwise we'll have an alcohol with a very high percentage of alcohol. So that's why, like, we have, like, a little bit less rules in Chile, so it's probably, like,
easier to make a Chilean pisco than a Peruvian pisco.
Now, you're based here in New York City?
Yes, we are now. We are both in Brooklyn and Bushwick, so we're going to stay here for a while.
And Elliot, you just joined the company. What's the mission?
As the mission, I think it's to understand how the American people love to drink cocktail and spirits, and to understand how the sailing works in USA. And the first mission for me is to have a good time as well with the American people.
So there'll be a little pisco as a part of that too.
Yeah, I hope I will sell a lot of pisco in New York.
And Matilda, last word from you about this whole adventure that you're a part of.
I actually discovered pisco when I came to New York, so I think it's a great product with a good history behind it. So I would like to bring some awareness of people, like make them discover pisco and like it as much as I like it. And yeah, I think that's pretty, it's my mission here, so I hope I will succeed.
So a young lady from Normandy and a young man from
Burgundy.
Yeah. We wish you a lot of success. It's been so nice to meet you both. And thank you so much for being part of On the Menu Radio. Emma Charon comes from a region in France where they make alcoholic beverages, which we can talk a little bit about. But we're in New York City at Star Chefs, and the thing that puzzles us is why all the young French people that we meet in New York are coming over here representing various forms of liquor. Can you explain?
Sure. I mean, we are a generation now that travels a lot, and we learn about all the different spirits from all around the world, and we fall in love with spirits that are not only from our countries, and so we like to spread the world and like spread our passions about the different spirits, even from different countries. So. Yeah, I guess we like to educate people about all the spirits that we discovered, and to make people learn about the unknown spirits.
And we have just sampled two from the United States, from a state called Iowa, where we don't associate the production of alcoholic beverages, but there's a reason why we should, and perhaps you can explain, Emma.
Sure. So Iowa is known as the Bell State, and this is where they do one of the best rye and also corn, and so they have a lot of space to grow their own grains, and so this it makes like one of the best whiskeys from the U.S. and we have a lot of success with it now.
Now, one of the things I noticed when we talked earlier is the mash bill, the what goes into the grain that goes into the liquor seems to be a lot richer than many of the whiskies made in the United States. So you're making sure that what's going on there is a really fine grain-based product.
Yes, we only use the best rye and the best corn that we can find to make the best spirits. Yeah.
And the ones we're talking about, let's recap. Tell us our listeners about the rye and the bourbon.
Sorry?
Tell our listeners specifically what the two spirits are that we're talking about that are made in Iowa.
So the two spirits that we talk about are the rye whiskey, which is 100% rye from like the grown on in the distillery, and the other one is the bourbon, which is 74% corn. And the rest is barley and rye.
And they're made by the same distiller?
Yes, we have a small team. 8 people are dedicated to the distillery, and it's actually they come from the same family, from father to grandfather, since the creation of the distillery. Yeah.
Okay, so Emma, let's record, get into the recording. How people can find out more information
and where they can buy this elixir of life.
So we have a website, which is Cedar Ridge, Iowa Distillery. And you can also find Cedar Ridge whiskeys in most retailers around the U.S., not only in New York City. And in some whiskey bars and good bars and restaurants around the U.S.
So you've been found by bartenders who are particularly discriminating.
Sorry?
You've been discovered by bartenders who are really discriminating in terms of what they want to put in a glass.
Yeah, so we interest bartenders that wish to discover new whiskey that nobody knew about. And so Iowa is one that they want to push, because people always thought about Kentucky or Tennessee for whiskey, but they're all the states that do it too.
Well, I think, what do we say, Emma? We say cheers, I think.
Yes, exactly, cheers.
Okay, listeners, the answer to your question is yes, it was a sound editor's nightmare. But we certainly hope you enjoyed these fascinating people that we were able to catch up with and bring to you. And we promise we'll do the same with some fascinating new guests and new subjects again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.